It is Thursday, and it's time to wrap up our series of political perspectives on WFSU-FM in this run-up to the November 4th general election. I'm Tom Flanagan. Thanks so much for tuning in via radio and also via TV, because we are also being broadcast over 4FSU Comcast Channel 4, with this program airing a couple of times over the next couple of weeks. And we thank our colleagues at WFSU-TV for making that possible. Before we begin, a reminder, you're always invited to be part of the conversation on Perspectives via phone and email. 414-1234 is the local number in the greater Tallahassee area if it's long distance from you to us. And we are also out in Panama City today over WFSW. 1-800-926-8809. If email is your preferred form of communication, you can drop us a line at perspectives@wfsu.org. And if you want to tweet, great, at WFSU Perspective. Of the dozens of congressional contests now on play nationwide, one of the most closely watched is the one for Florida's 2nd Congressional District. And if you've seen the map, it sprawls across the state's panhandle from Washington to Taylor counties. And representing that huge swath of real estate in the U.S. House of Representatives since 2011 is Steve Sutherland, Republican from Panama City, and he joins us here in the studio. Good to see you again, Congressman.
Good to see you, Tom. Thank you for having us in today.
Well, Perspectives also invited the Democratic challenger, Gwen Graham of Tallahassee, and her campaign cited a scheduling conflict, so she's not with us in the studio this morning. But we want to get into some of the issues that are facing the folks here in the 2nd, and with just a little bit to go before the election, I imagine that these views are in some cases getting more contentious than ever. But we will preface everything with the get-together you had with Ms. Graham at the Capitol Tiger Bay Club.
Yes.
Yesterday, October 15th, in contrast to back in late September when you guys were at the Capital City Country Club and things got a little bit testy at times, yesterday was like an exercise in amicability. Everyone was friendly. Everyone was focused on the issues. There was some admiration all around. Was that deliberate or just kind of happen?
No. I feel back in back at the first debate. I think Gwen would admit she came out swinging, and so I think yesterday was a wonderful event that we were. The temperature was a little down, and we were able to actually talk about issues, and I thanked her. I step into a big crowd like we did yesterday. You certainly don't want to make mistakes, and I think that the atmosphere yesterday was very conducive for a good discussion. And I commended Gwen on her performance of letting us have that, and we tried to operate in such a way that the people could learn. They could learn where we stand on issues. So I thought yesterday was well done. I can't commend Tiger Bay enough for the way that they had the thing set up. It was organized, plenty of room, a lot of media there. But I thought yesterday was very helpful to the voters, and that's what debates are supposed to be.
Well, we recorded all of that. We're going to be playing it back in pretty much its entirety, although it ran 1 hour and 19 minutes, I know, because I did the preliminary editing on it. Yeah. Last night. It was a great, great debate.
Yeah.
We'll have that on WFSU-FM coming up on, let's see, that will be a week from this Friday. So let's see, tomorrow is the 17th, I believe. So, yeah, a week from there at 7 o'clock right after Capitol Report. Both you and Ms. Graham, though, we're talking about the campaign ads and the influence of outside money in this race. And right before we went on the air, we were saying, my gosh, you've got to raise just millions of dollars to make this work. You both seem concerned about that.
Well, look, you raise your own money as a candidate, and Gwen has done that, and I've done that. And yet you're competing with so many outside groups for airtime. There's only so much bandwidth, and I think when someone is sitting in the comforts of their home and there's a commercial break on TV, and they're inundated by 5, 6, 7 ads, and it's just a flurry of activity, it's difficult as a candidate to get your message out and your message about you know, what's your agenda? What is your vision? And so, yeah, that's a challenge. And she's, you know, she's got to deal with that just like I do. So it is a lot of money coming in here from a lot of groups all around the country. We're not allowed by law to communicate with them and to coordinate those ads. So you never know when you wake up in the morning, you never know what you're going to be looking at on television.
Yeah, and does that
and you're going to see your picture. You
sure.
know,
so. Yeah. And does that worry you that, again, allowing that messaging to get away from the candidates and into the hands of third-party folks and then dumping so many of them in a concentrated place like the 2nd Congressional District mm-hmm. can actually turn voters off and say, I don't want to talk to either one of those guys.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's – and that's unfortunate. You know, the market, the media market here in Tallahassee and in Panama City, as cost go, are two of the most affordable markets compared to the rest of the state. So, you know, when you talk about $1 million being a $1 million ad buy, that goes a long way in Florida District 2. And so, yeah, I think the voters just start to turn things off. They're like, listen, we're just going to put it on mute. But that's not just – it's not because of us as candidates. It's really that outside money that's pouring in here outweighs what we're spending.
I even heard someone say, you know, boy, I can't wait till this is all over. I want to see some of those car dealer commercials again.
You know? Yeah, listen, I can say that I think Gwen would admit that we're both ready for this to be over. I know our families are. These are campaign seasons are tough on families, tough on our spouses and our children and our parents. And so, yeah, we're ready for this to be over. 19 more days the people have to endure. But let me say this: we were talking to the TV stations last night. They love it. The radio stations love it because obviously it's. Their revenues are certainly flying high right now.
Boy, I can imagine. Except they can only charge bottom of the rate card
yeah.
for politicals.
Yeah. Yeah, but those outside groups, they have to pay more than we pay.
That's right. They're not candidates.
No, they're not candidates.
There you got
it. We're creating jobs.
Yeah, there you go. It's an economic development tool.
Exactly.
414-1234 for perspectives. Eric is on the line right now. Hi, Eric.
Yes, I'd like to ask a series of very brief questions, four of them, just yes or no would be great, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Barack Obama has proposed some very specific policy changes to help the lower middle class and the working poor. And the Republicans have to date blocked all of these proposals. And I'd like to see what you think about the four of them. One of them is the – I'll just ask them and then I'll get off the air.
Okay.
Number one is the lowering of student rate loan percentages. And basically what they want to do is just tie them to the market rate so that college is more affordable for everybody, not just the wealthy. The second, of course, is the minimum wage, increasing the minimum wage. The third would be closing loopholes so that the extremely wealthy, I'm talking about people who make tens of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars a year, pay their fair share in taxes. And the fourth is to take that money and to sink it into public works projects like fixing roads and bridges and so on. And so those are his four specific policies. And I'd like to hear how you feel about those four. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, Eric. Thanks a lot. Okay, Congressman, let's see. Student loan, interest rate cap, minimum wage, close tax loopholes for the upper income folks, and invest in infrastructure. What do you think?
Well, first of all, Eric, thank you for calling. The student loan rate that you – and he wanted yes or no answers, and unfortunately that he didn't ask those in a yes or no way. Obviously, I disagree with the president and how he wants to address all of these things, I'm sure Eric finds that not to be so surprising. Listen, I think on student rates, I think that we did address that this year in a way that was passed by the House, passed by the Senate, and signed into law by the president. I think young students need to know, they need to have certainty. And I think that this year we avoided that. And so that was addressed. I think on the minimum wage, I think that we would be smart by addressing all wages for all people. And I think that this is where there's probably the largest disagreement between the Republicans and this administration. I think that people need to have opportunity. They need to know that in this country that if they work hard that they're going to be rewarded. And I think that right now you're seeing the lowest worker participation rate in 40 years. 62% of those in the workforce are working. So many people have left. They can't find jobs. And yet this administration is so determined to create an environment that small businesses, and this is not big businesses, it's small businesses. 80% of our economy is made up by mom and pops on main streets everywhere. Small businesses are everywhere here in Tallahassee. They're everywhere through Florida's 2nd Congressional District. And yet we've created a regulatory environment that they can't survive in. We've created an almost impossibility for them to go to their local banking institution, financial institution, and get the dollars necessary to expand their business. And when they do risk, and they do work hard, and if they are successful, they're going to be penalized because we've got the highest corporate tax rate of any developmental country in the world. I think that while Eric, his question is focusing on minimum wage, I'm focusing on a rising tide for all. And I know this, that America has the president's plan focuses on just a sector, and I want to focus on all. And I think on minimum wage, I'm going to disagree with the president and his plan there. I think Eric kind of showed his hand a little bit because he used the term fair share. Fair share, fair share. Let's continue to demonize people that that have benefited from hard work, and so I think that that we need tax reform. That's something I'm hoping that we will get into this coming year, I'm optimistic that we will be able to do something to make sure that taxes are affordable for all people. Public roads, listen, I served on the Transportation Committee. I'm very pleased that in my first term the Transportation Committee and the conference that negotiated the final version of the transportation bill, I was a conferee named to that process. So I worked to get that bill passed. It was passed. It's signed by the president into law because we need to make sure that our roads and our infrastructure is addressed, especially in Florida. Listen, Florida is a donor state. We collect dollars through the gas tax. We send that to Washington, D.C., and we only get back, and it varies from year to year, but it's been, 90 cent on the dollar, 93 cent on the dollar, and I hear the music. So,
yep.
but I wish I could address Eric's question in yes or no manner, but it's just impossible.
But we'll be right back here with more on Perspectives. Florida's 2nd Congressional District, one of the largest districts geographically in the whole country, just sprawling across the Florida panhandle. And since 2011, the representative in Congress for that district has been Steve Sutherland from Panama City. He's with us in studio. The Democratic challenger, Gwen Graham of Tallahassee, scheduling conflict. She was not able to join us today. Before we go back to the phones at 414-1234 or long distance, since we're also broadcasting in Panama City today, 800-926-8809. A follow-up to what Eric was talking about there, Congressman, when it comes to, again, providing a little bit of, I guess, assistance for folks in the middle class or maybe even who aspire to the middle class. Looking at maybe some of the folks down around, let's say East Point, which is firmly in the district here. A lot of fishing folks and families that have been in that line of work for multiple generations have fallen in many cases on hard times. Used to be wall-to-wall seafood processing houses along 98. Not today. What do we do with folks like that? Is there any responsibility that you think government at any level has to help those folks rearrange their lives to keep working hard the way they want to, but in another line of work? And what do you do with that without, you know, again, spending lots of federal money to do it?
Well, first of all, there's the seafood industry. That whole issue in the Gulf of Mexico is one. I serve on the fisheries subcommittee. So I have a front row seat for that issue. Just when you're talking about seafood in general, you're talking about the fisheries in general. Look, I'll look at the red snapper. That's a big issue in the Gulf of Mexico. The National Marine Fisheries has been a real challenge to work with. The red snapper, we have their own data. The National Marine Fisheries data has shown that the fishery was rebuilding in 2007. Now, in 2007, we had a 180-day recreational season and a four-bag limit. And we have their own data that shows that that was rebounding and rebuilding. And yet now, this year, in spite of that, this year we had to struggle through a 9-day red snapper season, knowing that there's more red snapper in the Gulf of Mexico. And I'm a fisherman. I grew up fishing on the Gulf. There's more red snapper, larger red snapper. And we know that you can't even get your bait to the bottom before red snapper are hammering your bait. And yet there's already talk by the National Marine Fisheries and by NOAA. And by the way, NOAA is a government agent, federal agency that works at the behest of the president, there's no signs at all to give fishermen more days to fish. There's talk about giving them less. The red snapper is not overfished. An arbitrarily low set quota based on the refusal to acknowledge the good data that's out there continues to put downward pressure on men and women and that fish for a living and that make their living through the fisheries. And so I think government in that regard is got to get out of the way. I know what's out there. I see the data. And specifically to East Point and Apalachicola, look, the bay, everyone you talk to, the bay needs a rest. The oyster harvesting there has been over-harvested. It needs a rest. There was a fisheries disaster declared by the Secretary of Commerce, and we wrote letters and we said it must be done. It must be done. There is a disaster there. We were proud to be a part of securing not as much as we would like, but at least $6.2 million that's going to Apalachicola Bay to help the oystermen there. Some that will continue to oyster, some that need training perhaps for a career change, but the bay needs a rest. And during that rest, oystermen will have the opportunity to be a part of shelling, oyster relays, moving bars, but also be given the opportunity to feed their families while they're trained for a new line of work. Some people will move on to different industries. We also have the water issue that we all know, the ACF issue, the Apalachicola, Chattahoochee, Flint, and the water flow issue coming down from Georgia. I believe the Corps of Engineers is wrong in not having to take into consideration downstream impact, especially impact around the Apalachicola Bay. That's a battle that's been going on for decades. But this year, there was some good language put in the Water Resource Development Act that says that if the three state governors do not come to a successful agreement, that Congress can and will get involved in that process to make instructions clear to the Corps of Engineers. So we got some language in that WERDA bill that I think is going to be good long term. But in the short term, the disaster funding I think will help. We work with Adam Putnam's office and the Secretary of Ag here in Florida. But the bay needs a break I hear people telling me that it needs a break for at least 18 months while the oyster beds replenish and come back. But listen, in so many ways, like the fisheries, I think agendas there to shut down the fisheries when really, you know, we import 98% of our seafood into this country. 98%. That's crazy. The damage done to our coastal communities is clear.
But if three governors can't get it together on that issue. How could the members of Congress, which have not, frankly, had a great track record in deciding things in a judicious way over the past several years, how can they work this thing out?
Well, I think, first of all, Governor Scott, has filed a lawsuit against the state of Georgia. There were two federal court decisions, one out of Atlanta, one out of D.C., so District 8, District 11, with differing opinions. And yet the Supreme Court refused to hear the case. So therefore, Governor filed a lawsuit against Georgia, a lawsuit that I agreed with, because when one state sues another state, it goes directly to the Supreme Court. So, I think we're having to work on this issue from a lot of different angles. But let's be clear, until the recently passed Water Resource Development Act, okay, that I was proud to have come out of our committee, until that act was signed into law, Congress did not have footing to get involved in that issue. We got language. There's language in that version, in that bill that's signed into law, that now Congress can and will address this issue. And I like our chances of being able to make our arguments that there's not enough water flowing down the Apalachicola. It's been taken by the Lake Lanier area around the Atlanta area, and also farmers in the southwest part of the state are wasting water. And we know that the southwest part of Georgia, they are wasting water. So we will continue to push on all fronts to find relief, both from water flow as well as from disaster funding, and also putting pressure to those that live along the coast that the fisheries would be managed properly. The insanity that I see operating the fisheries through the National Marine Fisheries and NOAA and the Gulf Council. In spite of the good data, we will continue to shed light on the way that they're mismanaging those fisheries.
414-1234 for Perspectives. Reed has been waiting on line one very patiently, I might add. Hi, Reed.
Hey, Tom. How are you today?
Real fine, thanks, sir.
Really sorry that Ms. Graham could not join your program today, because I would have liked to have gotten her perspective on this. I've noticed that the congressman has run just a slew of various advertisements, and I'm one of those that reads the paid for by line, because it's very important to me. Personally, I believe Citizens United was a great mistake for two reasons. Practically speaking, it gives corporations all the rights of citizenship, but I haven't seen them be forced to accept any of the responsibility. For instance, when they screw up, I don't see any of them going to jail. So I think that's a flaw. Number two, I believe in my heart of hearts that this influx of anonymous, huge millions and millions and tens of millions of dollars has corrupted our system of government. I would like the congressman's response to that.
Okay, great, Reed. Thank you. Congressman, you even talked about that here at the beginning of the show, the fact that all the outside money coming in can muddle up the candidates' own messages that they're trying to get out and confuse things.
Oh, yeah, and I agree with Reed in that regard. I think and it's on both sides. So I think, Reed says he reads those disclaimers at the bottom of the ads. Well, then, I trust he's also reading those disclaimers at the bottom of the ads that are coming after me. So it's on both sides. And I think anyone who is fair and looks at this objectively has to say, hey, when the message is coming through the TV and through the radio by outside groups ring louder than the candidates, that means that there's forces at play here to determine who represents a district. And I think that you can also look at FEC reports. And FEC reports will show that 74% of all of my individual donations into my campaign by individuals such as Reed into a campaign such as mine, 74% of those come from inside the district. And yet my opponent, 74% of her donations, individual donations, are coming from people outside the district. And so you can talk about big dollars and the Citizens United decision and these outside groups, but even down to the individual level, I think when 74% of the people that give to my campaign live in my district, and 74% of the people that giving to my opponent's campaign live outside the district, I think that's a glaring contrast as well.
Well, since everyone seems to hate this, is there anything Congress can do as far as hitting a point where, all right, we need to ramp this back a little bit?
Oh,
because
I think
so. It's consuming too much of your time. You got to be out hustling for money instead of governing. And I'd say that most of your colleagues in both the House and the Senate are saying the same thing. God, I hate this fundraising. It's driving me crazy. I have other priorities. And yet everyone keeps kind of working the same system.
Right, right. Somebody's got to hit the brakes here. Sure, and not only do we have to address this, or can we address this? But but obviously, I don't have any control over the judicial system, the court system on their rulings and the lawsuits that are filed, but yeah, I do think that cooler heads need to get their arms around this, and I think that Gwen and I have both agreed that's something that needs to be done. Listen, this is the most. This is one of the most hotly contested races in America, certainly a race that has gotten a lot of attention. So I can tell you that in my short political career, it never has meant more to me to address this issue. Okay, because my first two races weren't as high profiled as this one. So yeah, it means more to me now than it has. And so I will be moving in a way to address this. If I get through this on November the 4th, this becomes a priority for me.
Okay, let's see if Regina is still hanging here on the line. Thanks for holding on, Regina. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hi, and thank you for having me. Congressman Sutherland, I'm one of your constituents. I live in Tallahassee, and I've written to you at least three or four times over the past 3 years. I'm just getting my responses now. So I'm really curious to hear more about your views for education and what you can do for women's rights and for students like myself who are interested in furthering their education and going to college and not struggling with three or four jobs at a time.
Well, Regina, thank you for calling. Listen, you have the good fortune of living in a community that presents you a lot of options. One thing I've learned to appreciate about Tallahassee is the institutions that are here are fabulous. And I do think that education is critical to pursuing the American dream. I think the more equipped you are, I would say about your education, I think some of the career opportunities out there, you look at some of the markets that are out there, and I don't know what educational pursuits you have, but I think clearly as far as working, I know our girls, Samantha, Stephanie, Allie, and Abby. I've got two that have graduated from college. I have one that's currently in college now, and a senior in high school. All of our girls have worked since they were 15, and so they all worked through college. Stephanie down at the University of Central Florida, Samantha at FSU, at no point in time during their college career were they not working. I don't think work is a penalty. I think work is a responsible thing to do. I couldn't tell in Regina's question, if she was advocating that there would not be any work during college. I couldn't tell. But I know my girls have all worked through college, I think. I think college cost, I think, is too expensive, and I think the state should be weighing in on that. I think the cost of college is ridiculous, and I think I've never served at the state level, but I do know that the state university system is much of that cost is determined at the state level. So I apologize that I didn't serve in the state house, the state senate, but I think states should be doing more to make sure that college is affordable for those that want it. I know that our girls, both of us, Samantha and Stephanie, went to our junior college in Panama City before going off to college. because we felt like it was more economical for them to stay home. So they didn't graduate from college, from high school and immediately go off, move away to the big school. They went, they lived at home, saved money, worked, and put money in savings before branching out. And that was a way that we as a family could work together to be able to make sure that they were able to eventually go to their school of choice, and also go without having additional debt. So we worked together as a family to accomplish that.
Incumbent Republican Congressman from Florida's 2nd Congressional District, Steve Sutherland, our guest on Political Perspectives today, the Democratic challenger, Gwen Graham of Tallahassee. Scheduling conflict, wasn't able to be with us. You're invited to be part of the conversation, of course, at 414-1234 or 800-926-8809 if it's long distance from you to us here in Tallahassee. Also, we are being broadcast on TV via Comcast Channel 4, which is 4FSU, and thanks to the WFSU TV crew for making that possible. An email for Congressman Sutherland, and let's see, no name on this, but we'll go for it. Mr. Sutherland, you often talk about your deep family roots in Northwest Florida and your love for the environment. Please explain then why the League of Conservation Voters has given you a lifetime scorecard of 5% pro-environment and, let's see, zero for 2013, I believe.
Well, let me listen. Much of you know, many of these organizations to say that they're so concerned about their area that they don't get involved in the political process is not truthful. Look, I'm very proud of our record when it comes to the environment. As a co-author of the Restore Act, and for your listeners and the person who sent the email may not be aware of the Restore Act, so but I'm sure they're aware of the Deepwater Horizon and the explosion of the Macondo well in 2010 that caused you know, perhaps millions of gallons of oil to you know, flow into the Gulf of Mexico. I'm very proud that I joined in a bipartisan manner with our state senator Bill Nelson to author the Restore Act, to take the funds that will come to the Treasury as a result of the fines levied against BP because of violations of the Clean Water Act. And what we've done is we created a system where those dollars, 20% go into the U.S. Treasury, and 80% of those dollars flow to the five states that were affected by the disaster, their environment as well as their economy. So the Restore Act will restore both of those things, the environment and the economy. And listen, the Restore Act has been applauded by every environmental group in America as a very responsible way to address the damages that were done. I'm very proud that I have stood and held firm on the military mission line that splits the Gulf of Mexico to prevent oil drilling east of the military mission line. And I would assume the person who wrote that email would be pleased with my stance there. Fighting for clean water standards. Very well documented.
Hold that thought, Congressman. We'll be right back on Perspectives. Perspectives, politically speaking, that is, the 2nd Congressional District of Florida is our focus right now, and the incumbent Republican, Steve Sutherland, with us, and Gwen Graham out and about, I think, meeting with some veterans at this hour here. Following up on what you were talking about there regarding the Restore Act and the status of the Gulf as it recovers both physically and perceptually from the Deepwater Horizon situation, Congressman, you were talking about the military situation there. What's that all about?
Well, you know, we're blessed in North and Northwest Florida to have seven military bases. Just in Florida District 2, we have Tyndall Air Force Base and the Navy base in Panama City. Those two bases alone have a critical impact on the security of our nation, but they also have an amazing economic impact. Those two bases alone provide $2 billion of economic activity annually to our region. And so if you look at what they need, the reason that they're there and Eglin is there and the naval station there in Pensacola is because of the ranges, the training ranges that we have in the eastern side of the Gulf. So many years ago, Congress set in place what is called a military mission line to protect those ranges so that the training that goes on the air training that goes on will be protected. And so the military mission line, which is in place until 2023, I've continued to stand in firm support of that military mission line, in spite of efforts routinely each and every year, efforts to do away with that and abolish it to energy exploration to the east side. So I would think that people that are honest about environmental records would be pleased with that stance, as I believe they would on my co-authoring of the Restore Act.
I think we have a related question on Line 1 from Claudette. Hi, Claudette. Welcome to Perspectives.
Thank you so much. How are you today?
Real fine, thanks.
Good. My question relates to the whole issue of fracking and what the congressman's stance is on that.
Well, I think that just like any energy pursuit, I think that needs to be done in a smart way, in a safe way, and that precautions must be taken into consideration when pursuing it. To say that fracking cannot be done in a safe way, I don't think is correct. I obviously think that, just like drilling, I think that we have to learn from the mistakes that we have made, and we have to take precautionary measures to prevent bad things from happening. But to say that you're going to have a foolproof system where bad things don't happen, I think is not realistic. So I think we need to have the safest standards in the world, and I think America has the ability to create those, so that when we do use fracking, it's done in a way that is good for our economy, but also good for our environment. And I think there's a way. I don't think it's either or. I think you can have both.
Yeah, given Florida's particular topological sensitivity, though, with the aquifer situation mm-hmm. we have here, it's not like the Marcellus Shale in the middle of Pennsylvania, where most of the water supply there is not groundwater. It comes from reservoirs and surface-type things. Mm-hmm. Should there be no fracking zones in Florida, or do you think that takes it too far, or what?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to that. I think I've not had to make that decision yet. I know this. I know that before making a decision regarding a total prohibition, you know, you have to look at the good data, and you have to practice, inject common sense into the equation. Oftentimes, I think so many of the decisions are made out of ideology. You have some people that are so pro economy, they want to move forward with investment regardless of what it does to the economy, and then you have some people that are so pro environment that they say, I don't care about the economic opportunities that we're going to do away with, and I don't think either one of those should win. I think it's a blend. I think you have to say, hey, we have to consider both the environment and the economy, and do the very best we can to prevent bad things from happening, knowing that in life sometimes bad things do happen, but you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
During the past couple of weeks particularly, you've been really stressing your bipartisan street cred, if you will, the different instances in which you, if not even getting any kind of traction in the House with ideas, would go across to the Senate and see if you could get some things there. You still voted with the majority 96% of the time, though. Is that –
Well, I'm a Republican. I mean, I'm a Republican, and Florida's 2nd Congressional District is a conservative-leaning district. So I voted in a way, not because it was the majority, but because the bill that was on the floor aligned with my values and aligned with who I am. So I would expect the Democrat to vote with their minority party, just as I think that conservative legislation appeals to who I am. And so I'm always going to be more inclined to support, conservative legislation. I will say this. I mean, as far as the bipartisan street cred, I have to address that because, unfortunately, there's certainly been an effort to omit those things by many in the media. It doesn't seem to fit the narrative that Steve goes up and gets along with people. And yet, to be appointed as a freshman to the transportation conference that ushered in the Restore Act, and also to be appointed to the Farm Bill Conference that that ushered in, and both of those, the Farm Bill and the Transportation Bill and the Restore Act, were all signed into law. So to have those legislative accomplishments, you know, within my first 3 years, I'm very proud of that, and I think that it's worthy to be noted.
All right, David has been hanging on very patiently there, waiting for a reply. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. I hope you're both doing well, including the congressman. I've been very disturbed at having this gentleman represent this part of the country that I live in, a person who doesn't think $174,000 a year is too much or not enough. I, who have worked for 40 years, make $35,000 with a master's degree. I want to know why he is for voter suppression, reducing voter turnout, people who tend to vote Democratic, and why he voted to shut the government down, even as he kept the gym open for himself. So begin with it. How come $174,000 is not so much when it's 10 times what the average person makes in this country?
Thank you, sir.
Wow, that wasn't too partisan. But David, you know, thanks for calling in and expressing your partisan views. listen, clearly, David and individuals like David and the media outlets that I'm sure David reads know full well that my comment on the salary was totally taken out of context. And that Bill Cotterill, the reporter for the Tallahassee Democrat who did the original story, came back a week later. And David could look this up and read this and read the heading where Bill Cotterill said Steve Sutherland is being criticized for something he didn't even say. You know, I hate the world that we're living in, the sound bites, the mischaracterization, the slander, the defrauding, and the character assassination, you know. So, and look, I said yesterday at the Tiger Bay, and you heard me say this yesterday, I mean, does this physique look like something that came produced out of the congressional gym? I find some of these attacks comical, but listen, I look at the thing, the claims that David laid. I wouldn't want to talk about the issues that I think are most important to the American people either if my hand were on the wheel like this administration is overseeing. I mean, have you ever seen more chaos and out of control coming out of an administration? Listen, the president announced yesterday that now that we've had the second case of Ebola determined in Texas, now we're going to get very aggressive in how we handle it. Well, it seems to me that prudence would have said that when you knew that there was a possibility of any cases, that extreme caution would have been handled there. As someone who comes from a profession, it is important that I come from, we practice universal precautions every day. In every instance. But we see over and over again, whether we're talking about foreign policy or whether we're talking about the economy or whether we're talking about accountability through the IRS or NSA, or that this president continues, the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing. You know, I take David's questions in the way that I think he asked them. Not very seriously, and one that obviously is toting the water for a certain ideology.
Well, we'll get back to the phone, see if we can get a diversity of inquiry here on perspectives. Let's see. Let's go back to line one. Claudette had a follow-up. Hi, Claudette.
Well, it's actually not a follow-up question. It's a completely different topic in some ways.
Okay.
My question is, there are so many foods in our supermarkets and our stores that have been genetically modified, my concern is the big push that is in opposition to labeling those foods. And you can probably tell that I have some bias in this, which is fine. I would like foods labeled. And many states with Monsanto's, I hate to use the words, in bed with the government, in all parties, not just one, it seems that there's a big push to keep that labeling from happening. So what is your position on that? If it came to a vote, how would you vote?
Okay, thanks, Claudette.
Well, first of all, I agree with Claudette. I mean, common sense would say that, hey, you have the right to know what is in the food you're buying. I don't have a problem with that. If the vote was clearly that simple, that cut and dry, unfortunately, what's amazing that I found about Washington, D.C. is rarely is the vote that simple. It's incredible, and I found this aggravating as a new legislator that I love single issue votes, you know, that up or down based on, you know, just the simplicity of the issue. But unfortunately, oftentimes you look at an issue, and it's been garbaged down and weighted down by other things as well. But listen, I think Claudette, listen, your question is based in common sense, and I give you a common sense answer. Anyone who's buying food deserves to know what's in it, and I find that that seems simple.
And truth in labeling. Then, Cindy, you've been hanging on line two there. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. So I'm the breadwinner for my family, and I know a lot of women are in similar situations. So I've got to say that I'm a little discouraged that you decided to vote against equal pay for women. Can you speak a little bit to why you voted against a bill that would help raise wages for families?
Well, first of all, Cindy, to the premise of your question that I would be in some way wanting women to be paid less is just ludicrous. It's just not true. Susan and I have four daughters: Samantha, Stephanie, Allie, and Abby. To try to further this idea that I would want my girls to make less if they did the job and put in the time and did the job at a superior level, that I would want them to be paid less, I just think is laughable. And so, you know, look, 60% of my staff, my congressional staff, are women. My two deputy district directors here in the east side of the district is Lori, and the west side is Melissa. My business partner is my mom, my sister. I just think this, you know, to continue to perpetuate this idea that I in any way want women to have less is I think a need that the left has to have, but total falsehood.
Okay, Wilbur, line four, go ahead.
Thanks for exposing yourself to this anyhow. I'm a hold-my-nose Democrat, and the shape of your district is at least one argument from my point of view. I'm also a hunter and a veteran, and I have found that development permanently destroys hunting. Now, you portray yourself as staunchly pro-development and staunchly pro-hunting, and I don't actually expect you to answer this question, but I'd like you to think about how hard those positions are to reconcile. Thanks a lot, man.
Thank you, Wilbur, and thank you for your kind remark. I am a developer. I believe in someone that's pro-development, and I'm also a hunter, avid. I'm a concealed weapons permit holder, and I've been hunting as a young child. I still hunt today, and I certainly look forward when I walk out early in the morning and I feel crisp air. I'm ready to. I know it's close to going to hunt again. I do believe in freedom, though, and I believe that I believe in property rights. And our founding fathers had a clear commitment to property rights and the rule of law. And so if there is I believe that when you own a piece of property, I believe in sensible development. And so it's a delicate balance. I lease and pay to hunt on the property that we hunt on. I could make a choice to do something different with that dollar. There is opportunity cost. I do believe in property rights, and I believe that you have to make choices.
You talked about a delicate balance there, or as some people refer to it as a tap dance. For instance, when you have, for example, a beautiful plantation just north of town here that has been leased by hunters for generations,
right,
and then suddenly someone comes in, and yes, they can buy it, and within the parameters of the regulation that we have, put a housing development there.
Sure.
There's no more hunting on that property.
Yeah, but that was the property right of the individual who owned it. But let me tell Wilbert one thing that aggravates me even more than sometimes losing a good piece of hunting property. What aggravates me is that when there is a land easement, and by the way, I serve on Natural Resources Committee, and so we oversee this part. When the federal government buys land in the state of Florida, there are 28 wildlife refuges in the state of Florida, 1 million acres of land. Every time that land is purchased, and when they come, when the wildlife services, when the forest services come to make their pitch to want that, they always sell it. Here is going to be future hunting opportunities for men and women, boys and girls. So that's one of the reasons we need to buy more property. And that sounds good. Unfortunately, of the 1 million acres in the state of Florida that are owned by the people, okay, under the care of the federal government, only 28% of that land, 280,000 acres of the million, do we have access to? Do sportsmen have access to? And so if Wilbert, I share with him his concern, but I hope that knowledge, okay, that we only have access to 28% of the 1 million acres, I hope that Wilbert can focus his attention on pushing people in federal offices to open up that land for the purpose in which it was originally purchased, and that was to conserve it, but also to allow sportsmen the opportunity to enjoy it with their families.
The incumbent in Florida's 2nd Congressional District, Republican Steve Sutherland of Panama City, thanks so much for coming on Perspectives today,
sir. Thank
you.
This was great.
Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee, Taylor Cox and Lydell Rawls on the radio side, and we thank our crew from WFSU-TV, Mike Dunn, Suzanne Smith, along Jason, Adrian, Dan, Paul, the entire gang. I'm Tom Flanagan. Next week we'll be taking the week off because we have Pledge Drive on. We'll return in 2 weeks right here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcasts. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.